So again, my name is Lisa Hepp, and I will be presenting on behalf of Dr. Stillman, who is on her way to Bangkok. We wish that she was here, but Bangkok's always nice, I guess, too. So I'll be presenting on a secondhand smoke study that we did in Vietnam in 9 hospitals there, following a protocol that the Institute has used in several other countries, but specifically in hospitals similar to what Heather has mentioned already in her previous presentation. Before I begin, I just wanted to mention I have no financial relationships to disclose at this time. The learning objectives that I hope to cover with this presentation include sort of this theme that we've been talking about for the past hour or so, is to understand how capacity is built in a country like Vietnam, specifically for tobacco control, and then determine the processes taken to implement and go through with the study in Vietnam in the hospitals, and then how that data can actually be used to increase awareness for the tobacco law and to also demonstrate that secondhand smoke is also something that needs to be really considered. So Vietnam is currently at a critical junction. On one hand, you have the government is heavily invested in the tobacco industry, which is common in a lot of countries overseas. And you're seeing increased smoking rates, especially among men, at a rate of approximately 49%, which then means that you also have an increase, likely, in secondhand smoke exposure among women and children, which then is likely to lead to an increase in premature deaths. WHO estimates that if this isn't addressed, that approximately 10% of the population is likely to die early from premature deaths, so it needs to be addressed. But Vietnam has taken on steps on their own to handle the problem. In 2004, they signed and ratified the WHO FCTC. They do currently have smoke-free regulations on the books, particularly in indoor offices and in healthcare facilities. Unfortunately, as we see in many other countries, they're just not heavily enforced or strictly enforced at the present. So these are areas that we really need to address to build a strong tobacco control program, our tobacco smoke-free legislation in Vietnam. So Atlantic Philanthropies recognized the work that was being done and the need that existed in Vietnam and funded Johns Hopkins, specifically our Institute for Global Tobacco Control, for a 5-year program to work in a capacity-building partnership with the Ministry of Health in Vietnam, specifically there, the Vietnam Committee on Smoking and Health, also known as VINACOSH. So we're currently in the 4th year of a 5-year project. So the Institute of Global Tobacco Control and VINACOSH formed what we call the RSVP project, or the Reduced Smoking in Vietnam Partnership. The main goals there, again, are the FCTC to implement that and to help, again, improve government capacity in conducting tobacco control programs and establishing policies. This is a schematic here of how VINACOSH is sort of working in terms of capacity. So you have the current partners, you have AP, or Atlantic Philanthropies, the Bloomberg Philanthropies, you have Hopkins, you have WHO and others that are working at a top level with VINACOSH, and then VINACOSH is sort of working down then with RSVP project, with WHO, and then with the Bloomberg Philanthropies. At the bottom there, you see the main objectives of sort of each of those partners, and the common one being, again, tobacco control law. So the RSVP's projected outcomes that we hope to accomplished by the end of the 5-year project is again to enhance national policies to reduce tobacco use, to increase capacity within selected ministries to develop and implement and evaluate tobacco control programs. And this last one is one that I'll be speaking more directly to with the secondhand smoke hospital study, which is to increase capacity within the MOH in conducting monitoring and surveillance. To date, we have had milestones. I know we keep talking about the challenges, but we have had successes, and it's really important to bring those to the forefront so that everyone sees that there are difficulties, but even the small little successes really does make a big difference. So there's been a huge success in working between the ministries on tobacco control issues, which has been really pushed forward by VINACOSH. We were able to help VINACOSH collect data specifically for the FCTC report. We initiated a data collection system with other partner ministries, We've been able to help in the development of a draft national tobacco law that was first helped out with the Swedish CETA, and we've also been able to add some advocacy to gain support for the law. So just briefly, an overview of the tobacco control law in Vietnam. 2009, we hope that it goes before the National Assembly and will be implemented. It is in alignment with the FCTC. And even though the law is hopefully going to be enacted in 2009, Vinakash is taking steps already to work in hospitals and making them smoke-free, and then using this information and data to push to other areas. I'll go ahead and just skip this. So our role in support of the law has been to provide some outside expert consultation. We've been working with TFK to help review the tobacco control law and provide some feedback to the Ministry of Health, and to take a look at that and add it to them, the law and the regulations. We've been supporting workshops with Vinakash for members not only of the various ministries but also of the National Assembly. And then we are organizing a study tour at the end of this year in December to bring ministry members and National Assembly members to Hong Kong to take a look at their plan and to hopefully learn how they've done that, their work there. So as I said, Vinakash has been working to implement smoke-free hospitals, and they're critical environments to work in, not only because most of society recognizes them or sees them as role models and that they set a standard for people to follow. But it's also important to realize that not only do hospitals treat people, but we also should help them, have them see prevention as a big part of that as well. If you work in hospitals, we hope to find support that can be used in other environments as well. So our three main objectives, very similar to all of the objectives that Heather has mentioned in her previous presentation, were again to measure indoor air nicotine levels in 9 of the hospitals there, then to assess knowledge and attitudes through surveys of hospital staff in Vietnam, and then to use this study as a baseline measure of secondhand smoke exposure to support more progressive smoke-free policy in other areas. So as I mentioned, the hospital study was conducted in 9 hospitals in 3 different regions in Vietnam, the northern region being Hanoi, the middle area being Hue, and then several different cities in the southern region of Vietnam. It was a convenient sample. Vinakash, with some outside collaborators, picked the 9 hospitals to go to for various different reasons, and but they went ahead and contacted them, asked them if we could come and set up this study, survey their employees, and do some observational study as well. So this is a pre and post study. We'll have an intervention in the middle. We just finished the pre portion of the study. We actually just received the data from Vietnam. We haven't actually analyzed all of it at the present, so I'll only be presenting on the survey data and some of the observational data. But there is also air monitoring as well with the passive monitors that Heather presented. And again, here's what the monitor looks like. So the study, the pre-portion of it, was over a 2-week period. On day 1, we had the field workers went out and they placed the monitors. They conducted observational data, or evaluations. They went around the hospitals looking for no smoking signs, looking for people smoking in areas, documenting all of this, counting the number of smokers. They also went around and cleaned up certain areas, looking for cigarette butts. They would go back and then clean it up again and count how many cigarette butts were found to give an indication that over a 5-hour period, smokers were present there. On day 7, then they would return to ensure that the monitor was still there, do observational follow-up, and then on day 14, they would retrieve the air monitors and conduct observational surveys again. So this table here just highlights sort of a schematic of where we thought it was best to conduct the study, since it was in multiple places in Vietnam. We wanted some consistency so that we could summarize it in the end. So we selected, with the help of Vinakash, departments that we thought people might be smoking, there might be a lot of people in those areas. So we decided with the emergency department, outpatient department, cafeterias and stairwells So in total, each hospital was given approximately 21 monitors to place. So we then took a trip to Vietnam, as Heather said. It's really important to have some training there to build capacity as well. So Fran and I, this is Fran. We went to Vietnam and we worked with Vina Kosh to get some field workers and field coordinators present to come to the training so that they could go back then to their various areas and train the trainer type of situation. At the two-day training, we took them around to the hospitals to show them what exactly it was that we were looking for. So we went to a waiting room, which is in the upper right-hand corner, and we went to cafeterias and to the patient rooms and to doctor's lounges. Again, basically just walking through the protocol and the field forms together. Challenges, again, would just be the language barrier. I was there. I don't speak Vietnamese, unfortunately. And we just really needed to make sure that the translator was accurately describing what it is that we're looking for and how we really needed to put the air monitors in places that people wouldn't interfere with them, but also at the same time that they weren't so hidden and, you know, enclosed with drapes or something like that, that they weren't going to be able to collect any of the nicotine in the air. Then the trainers at the field training, they went back to their various regions, as I said, and they did the training. And the lower bar here, you see that they were placing the monitors. Very creative here. Someone actually taped the monitor up because they wanted it in that area. So this is a table highlighting some of the observational data that was collected. As I mentioned, they just went around the outside of the campus. They wanted to see if they had any sort of signage, anything posted that this was a smoke-free campus, that no smoking was allowed near the, you know, patio areas or near the windows. So majority of the hospitals, as you see across the front row here, yes, meaning that there were smoking signs present, but N meaning no, smoking signs were not present. Majority of them did say something about the campus or the outside area needing to be smoke-free or not allowed to smoke outside as well. And then on the inside, they also went into the lobby, the OPD or outpatient department, and cafeterias, and were looking for the signage. And not really surprisingly, every place where there were patients, technically, you weren't allowed to smoke or there was signage stating that. But in the cafeteria, it was a little bit more loose. And you see that as well in the lower section, whether smoking was restricted there. Cafeterias were generally not restricted. Cigarette butts were found, not really surprising as well. But the range of cigarettes found, so we had a huge range. Some of the hospitals had zero. Across the different areas, and some of the hospitals in the southern region, over a five-hour period, they collected 216 cigarette butts. So that's quite a substantial amount of smoking going on. They did it again on another day, and we see similar numbers. So this next table is just a demographics table of the survey participants. So each hospital, we collected surveys from 100 staff members. From similar departments where we place the air monitor, in the air emergency rooms, internal medicine departments, outpatient departments, and surgery. We see that the age range is approximately the same across all of the regions. Education is more or less the same, except in the southern region, you see a higher percentage of the survey participants were actually high school was their highest education level, whereas in the other two cities or regions, They were mostly college educated. They were mostly nurses. A few were just what they classified themselves as another type of employment status. And approximately 75% of them were never smokers, meaning that they hadn't smoked, or they had smoked less than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime. One of the questions we asked them to evaluate during the survey, I should back up a little bit, I should say, that the field workers went into staff meetings and distributed the surveys at each of the departments and gave their little speech in terms of consenting or an oral consent and asked them if they wanted to participate. If they did, they were obviously asked to stay. If they didn't, they were free to leave. So there could be some bias here because superiors were also in the staff meetings. So some of these questions may be answered what they thought their superior would like them to answer instead of actually what was their feelings on some of these things. So we asked them to evaluate their air quality of their hospital in terms of the tobacco level that they smelled, tobacco smoke level. So the majority of them felt that it was fair or a good smoking status, not too much. We asked them how frequently that they did smell tobacco smoke specifically. Majority of them said infrequently. Even when we looked across smoking status amongst never smokers, current smokers, and former smokers. We also asked them to rate whether or not they felt a hospital should be a smoke-free environment. And again, majority of them felt that it should be a smoke-free environment. But of course, you see it's a little bit more on the never smokers and former smokers than the current smokers. And again, you see this difference when we asked about the smoking habits of the hospital staff, whether they actually influence others or serve as role models. And you see that the majority of people strongly agree on that as well, but that current smokers were a little bit more evenly distributed or higherly distributed among the different categories than the other two, never smokers or former smokers. So across all of the cities, approximately 75% of the staff felt that a smoking ban would improve the hospital's image. And a majority did feel that smoking harms not only non-smokers, but also smokers themselves. So this is a good indication that, you know, we can go in there and try to establish a smoke-free ban and have some success because they're in support of it. They understand that it's needed there. And 56% of the staff, unfortunately, feel that it's going to be difficult to enforce. So hopefully with the intervention that we implement in the next several months, we can change that perception. And when we go back for the follow-up, we can see the difference there. So in conclusion, non-smokers and former smokers were more likely to support a smoke-free policy just from this preliminary data that we took a look at. 10 to 20% of those interviewed did smell smoke while they were at work. So using multiple methods, observational data, survey collection, and air monitoring data provides useful tools to the audience to recognize the need for stronger regulation. So the current needs in Vietnam are the tobacco law, which we hope to have enacted in 2009, as well as evidence-based data is needed to support the policies. They need resources such as a secondhand smoke hospital resource guide, which I believe Vina Kosh is looking into developing. And they need to take this study beyond the 9 hospitals and expand it. So just briefly in summary, hospitals and other healthcare facilities are critical venues for introducing smoke-free policies. The RSVP project will provide important evidence to support the adoption of the tobacco control law and other associated secondhand smoke policies. So we'd like to just thank Atlantic Philanthropies for their funding, as well as Ms. Rose Nathan, who was our expert consult on the tobacco law in Vietnam. So, thank you. So again, the challenges, as I mentioned, were language was a barrier. The time in terms of responding was sort of a barrier. We were pressed up against some roadblocks. We needed to have something submitted to the IRB. We needed to have the air monitor sent in a timely manner. And just working with that major time difference was an issue, but also trying to communicate that we were, you know, up against the clock and trying to get this done was a little bit difficult. Fortunately, we have a collaborator who's actually here in the audience who works with us directly and then will communicate with our office in Vina Kosh there to help speed things along and has been a really savings grace for us. So.
We have the customs.
Oh, and then we also did have a major customs issue with the air monitors. We were working with, as I said, Vina Kosh, who is an office with the Ministry of Health. So we needed to send the air monitors through them since they were our main partner. Unfortunately, sending things through the government took a considerable amount of time, again, pushing us really back on our timeline. The monitors didn't actually get there, so we Fran and I actually had to bring air monitors with us. We were stopped by customs several times because we had two large suitcases with all of these little tiny things in plastic little baggies. In little plastic, you're like urine cups. They opened them up and we got questioned several times in China and in Vietnam as well when we were trying to get there. But we had our notices stating what it was we were doing and our intention, so they let us through. So now we know it's a little bit better to maybe bring the things through instead of mailing them directly through the government there, or working through an NGO might actually be the best way to mail things through. So thank you.
Does anybody have any questions?
Obviously, at Hopkins, we have a lot of resources available. So what we've done initially is we fund them both for the field work and for all of the monitors and all for the analysis. And then after that, we start weaning ourselves off of them. So, for example, if they want to do the study, we provide the monitors. They take care of their field work. And so we have a lot of studies that they develop that they want to do, and then we provide free of charge monitors, hair analysis, and we provide that as a service to them. And then if they do get a grant, we help them a lot to write grants and submit them with funding for those things. And so then if they get those grants, then they give us a small nominal amount of money to provide that service back to them. But we continually work with them to submit grants, to be incorporated into our new projects, and then to help them if they want to do some free, we encourage them to do it, and we'll help, we'll give you the stuff if you need it.
So if you're talking about writing this grant, then you're the idea of sponsoring?
Yeah, we often put our name on there.
Like a letter of support.
A letter of support, yeah, and that we would provide them with resources.
A comment. For example, in Mexico, there's CONACYT is a funder, it's a national council that can provide money for researchers. So the INSP, the Department of Tobacco, they put in a proposal for having different government buildings to be monitored for secondhand smoke, and they also, we had their lab technician to come to Johns Hopkins and have learned how to analyze their passive air monitor. So now we have done a validation study with them, so their lab can do, they can do their own nicotine analysis, they're doing their own field work. So in that case, Mexico is working by themselves on this project.
Yeah, so. And we've done that in India too, built labs. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is this panel is very Hopkins heavy, in case you didn't notice. So the other thing was we do is obviously work with a lot of different groups and make sure, you know, that they're working with a lot of different people and not just Hopkins, and put them in touch with our research network.
3 minutes.
Dan.
I just have a comment on this customs problem. We're not all done with the analysis. We've gone to China collecting urine samples on like cigarette smokers, and getting that out of China, getting this stuff in wasn't so bad. Getting all the same, especially biological samples out. And we finally actually hired a customs broker, which only cost us about $150. But it was really worthwhile because I think postdoc was working on what we call there. And so that's, getting this stuff in, we had similar, we were taking in a bunch of little,
right.
Say, baggies, you know. But it really, I had thought these customer work is really expensive, at least on the income plus, and it really helps.
Yeah, we had a we haven't done that, but that's why we went to hair. I see Marion's in the office. So Marion actually started the study of potenine, doing saliva studies in 4 countries. And after about 6 years, we finally gave up on getting the potenine saliva samples out of India. I mean, it was just, it was impossible. And so when we wanted to do a very large study, we just felt that saliva and urine was too hard to transport. Even if you could get it out, it's so difficult. And so, you know, but the customs officer is a great idea, because even when you have all the codes right, it still gets stuck. The best story is in India this last year. It got stuck so long that finally the health ministry put an editorial in the newspaper accusing the finance ministry or the customs ministry of holding resources that were being donated to the government by Johns Hopkins University, and it got out the next day.
Okay. We're going to get kicked out of here, so I'm sorry to say that's it. Thank you.